Hi, I'm Joe.
And I'm Dave.
And we're the hosts of the Chasing Tomorrow podcast, where we bring you stories that delve into the science and spirit behind intriguing people doing extraordinary things.
Welcome to the Chasing Tomorrow podcast. This week is episode 60, with less than 1 month to go before Big's Backyard. This month is going to be all about Big's and backyard racing. This week, we have Ireland's backyard national record holder, Keith Russell. Now, Keith, in May of this past year, he ended up winning the last one standing backyard by running 63 hours. It's 422 kilometers. I think that's rounding out about 10 marathons back to back. Keith is also represented Ireland in the 100 kilometer championships. Keith is a hell of a guy, and I've never met him before, but we just ended up doing some talking before this podcast episode, and I can't wait to introduce you to this guy. I'm looking forward to running many miles with him down in Biggs in less than 4 weeks. Welcome to the Chasing Tomorrow podcast, Keith.
Well, Dave, how's it going? Thanks very much for having me on.
Doing great.
Thanks for reaching out.
The thing that's interesting, Keith, because I'm sure this is, because I love asking sort of the question about sort of where did you start? But the part that's being sort of more and more interesting to me is, even if we started as runners, none of us imagined ever running these last person standing kind of races, because first they didn't really even exist. And then let alone having that sort of be part of someone's journey, because they're crazy. And of course, 63 laps, loops, yards, whatever you want to call them, is just incredible. So like, how do you get there? Like, were you a football player in Ireland when you were younger, or you're a runner in school? Like, were you just a kid riding your bike around? I mean, like, how does it go from probably just growing up in Ireland to now owning records?
Well, to be honest, like, that backyard was my first backyard ultra. But I started ultra running in, March 2019 would have been my first ultra race. But
wow.
Before that, like, I didn't do running growing up. I didn't like running at all. I played football, I played hurling, I played Gaelic football, two Irish sports here, and played a bit of golf growing up. But I wasn't never really committed to training, or I was smoking, I was drinking growing up. You think like you're living a great life. You're young, you're stupid, I suppose. Yeah. And like I had a daughter who was a survivor of twin girls. Her sister Isabel was stillborn, and Alana grew up with special needs, so she was spastic quadriplegia cerebral palsy. And we had to fundraise to renovate our house for Alana, because she was wheelchair bound. She couldn't walk, she couldn't talk, she was peg fed. So she was very, very high needs. And we fundraised about €80,000 to renovate our house for her. And then I basically just wanted to give back to somebody else. So I approached Alana's school. So it would be a special needs school. And I just said to them, look, I want to help you out and raise money to upgrade your wheelchair accessible. But they sort of laughed at me at the time, because I told them I was going to have it done within a year. And we were looking to raise about €70,000. So that the plan was for me and Alana to run Dublin City Marathon in 2017. So I gave myself a year to train for that. And in the meantime, just fundraising for the bus as well. So before the marathon, we got all the money raised. So going to marathon day was just, this was the finish line. This was it. This was one of the best days of my life. Like, it was my second marathon. I actually ran a marathon in the June of that year, just to make sure I could run a marathon myself before I took on to run it with her.
Yeah. So Keith, what about this marathon? Like, what did that look like? Were you pushing Alana during the race?
Yeah. So what I started off doing, so we started off just doing 5K park runs. So what I do is tilt her day-to-day wheelchair back on his two wheels. It was three laps of the park. And I got in touch with a guy here who was running with another young fella. And he had a three-wheeler chair that he lent. And eventually then I upgraded that. I got a proper racing chair donated to me by my father's company. So I had a proper running chair. Alana's day-to-day chair clicked out of that chair and sat into this frame of the running chair. So she was completely comfortable. It was a chair that was molded to her, and that's what we trained with. That's what we used.
How old was Alana?
Alana at the minute is the youngest ever participant and finisher of the Dublin City Marathon, and still is to this day. She was 7 years of age.
Okay. Thank you. I just wanted to know that.
Yeah, there's a couple record holders there. That's great.
Yeah. Yeah, so it was brilliant, and it was absolutely amazing day. We traveled the country here in Ireland, just doing different races, training runs. We'd go down to the Phoenix Park, which is in Dublin. It's one of Europe's biggest parks, and we go down and train down there. Like I'd wake her up at 5 o'clock in the morning. I'd grab her by the legs and drag her to the end of the bed and go, "Come on, Alana, we're running." And she just starts smiling. When like the biggest question I get asked is like, "How did you know she enjoyed it? How did I know that she liked it?" And Alana would have been very agitated growing up. She's very frustrated, and I think it's because she couldn't really communicate with anybody. We knew what she wanted her because we were around her all the time, her mood, screaming and shouting and laughing and crying. But when I put her in the chair, she dozed off. She was so relaxed. She was so comfortable. I think she was very stimulated by the sounds of the cars, the sounds of the birds, the sounds of the trees blowing, and even people just flocked to her. They just, she had this aura about her. She had this most beautiful smile you'd ever see. And people just got so attracted by her, and she was just taken in by the Irish people and the Irish running community.
Absolutely. Yeah. And Keith, and I know exactly where you're coming from. I've got a special needs son, and he's 12, and he's got a mobility disorder. It's a rare disease, but yet the needs aren't as expansive as Alana's. But from a very young age, he had a hard time getting around. And so that was a bonding thing that he and I did a lot, as running in the jogging stroller. He's 12 years old. He's probably going to be taller than me within the next 6 months. So the stroller gets harder and harder, that they get. But it's hard to find strollers like that. You can end up finding special needs strollers for adult people. But it creates an
amazing bond between you, doesn't it?
It is. When you're running and when they're there, you are one. It's an incredible bond, isn't it, Keith?
Yeah, and I think as well, that's probably what people took to as well, was like, it was like a daddy-daughter bonding thing that we done together. And it was just amazing. Like for me, like say going to Dublin City Marathon, it's, as I said, like growing up, I wasn't really committed to football. I wasn't committed to sports. To do the marathon, I gave up smoking, I gave up drinking, and I was 100% into this, and I was doing this. And I was going to make her proud, and everybody else that sort of believed in me and what we wanted to do. I was going to prove all them right, that to support us and really believe in us, like, you know.
Absolutely. How much money did you end up raising that day?
We raised 70,000. Oh, yeah.
So the what was it like running in the marathon with her? I mean, it's a pretty big marathon. It's a well-known marathon around the world, really. And it must have been, marathon is hard. For anyone, right? There's never easy to run 6 miles. Now you're pushing a stroller, and of course you feel good about it, but you have this extra effort that you have to put into it. How did it feel doing the race?
Yeah, like running, you have your arms to help you propel you along. Right. When you're pushing a chair, you don't have that. Some people think because you're holding onto the back of the chair, you're not working as hard. You're pushing probably about the guts of 40 kilos. On the flats, it'll cruise along. You can hold it one hand and run beside it. Going downhill, you just make sure you don't let go of the chair. But going uphill is where it gets tough. Like the pressure comes on your glutes, your hamstrings, your calves. They take all the pressure because you're trying to propel this up the hill. Like I always said to Alana, like no matter what race we do, I'll always get her to the finish line. And that was that's what we stuck to. And the first race was probably 3 weeks before that, we'd done a 3-quarter marathon, and full of confidence at this stage, when went out too fast, and the last 6K was just complete torture, absolute torture. But I suppose it taught me lessons for the main race itself then, of like, okay, I need to be disciplined. Not go out too fast, and just sort of basically enjoy the day as well at the same time.
Did you know of this Dick Hoyt in the United States? Yeah. His son, he pushed forever. He died recently at 80 years old. Yeah. I kept thinking Dick was like eternal. He always looked like this young, strong, amazing guy. But I think that it really opened up our eyes a lot to both that relationship you guys have, as well as that we don't need to close the world down for people who are different, right? That
can not.
Open
Definitely
up not. The world. And what you did and do, and Dave and others, is just beautiful because we are different no matter what, right? Whether special needs or regular people. And so it's great to have people like you who are not closing down opportunities for people, family or otherwise, and opening it up. And I hope we just celebrate this more and more. Dick got some good attention in the US. We need to have that happen more. So yeah.
I think he helped so many people as well to get out there and to go out with the kids with special needs, because basically to show you this is what you can do. You don't need to keep them at home, or we integrate them into the community as well. And like, I always looked at it that we were giving Alana a new lease of life. We were putting her out. And it was really only, I was doing a race myself and I was like, oh my God, I was thinking about it the complete different wrong way. She changed my life. She gave me a whole new lease of life. She showed me what it was like to live. She showed me that I would never have discovered running if it was not for Alana. So she completely changed my life.
So Keith, it reminds me as well too of another guest that we've had on the Juicing Tomorrow podcast, Blaine Penny. Blaine Penny is a Canadian, a very good friend of mine, who is an exceptional runner. He's a sub 230 marathoner. He's a beast. But he also has a child with a rare disease called mitochondrial disease. And he continues pushing Evan. And Evan's now a grown young man. Evan's probably 17 years old now. But it's one of those things that I was really struggling with at the very beginning when I founded my foundation, Outrun Rare, because all of a sudden my son is now at the forefront of a lot of messaging. And as a parent, you never want to. Yeah, we could put ourselves out there, Keith, but putting our kids out there. And so Blaine pulled me aside one day when I was talking to him about a lot of these concerns. And he said, Dave, you have to understand that the world is going to be rooting for you. When he says your concerns and fears of privacy and on and so forth, the very best thing you could do is go to people and say, my name is Dave Proctor. This is my son. And we need support and we need help.
Honest,
people come out and people are full of love. As much as you go into Facebook the messaging today and everybody's angry and pissed off and throwing one another under the bus, people are inherently good. Is that what you noticed as well too with running with Alana?
Absolutely. As you touched on there, Dave, like you put yourself out there is one thing. You put your child out there, and if you get anything negative back, it's going to hurt. It's going to really, really hurt. And that's something that we sort of take a chance on. And it's something I suppose that not a lot of people would take a chance on in case of that happening. Because with social media, people just take a gripe and that's it. Like, there's no going back from it at all. And like, that's a reflection on them. That's not a reflection on you or us or anything like that, you know? And no, I never got any bad words and never got any bad publicity. It was all very positive. People just want to help. And the thing about it is people don't know how to help you. All they want to do is help. When I was fundraising for my house and for the bus, there was people I didn't even know coming forward and donating to me, like a couple of thousand. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And it was only after I was still fundraising after we'd done the book, I was still fundraising for other things for, say, families with kids with disabilities. And I would see somebody on, say, Facebook or on GoFundMe or whatever, and I go, something would draw me towards, I want to help them. So I would contact them and I would donate couple of thousand to them. I don't know them, they don't know me. And it's not for them to turn around and go, oh, thank you very much, oh my God, I like nearly bowing to it. That's not the case at all. It's I know what it's like for someone to come to you and go, I want to help and this is how I can help. And it's an amazing feeling to get it, but even to do it and not expect anything, it's just so gratifying. It's just so and I have friends that do that too and want to help with what I do and are fully supportive of what I do. And it's okay. What are we going to do and how can we help?
Keith, what's really interesting, when Dave and I set out on this, we wanted to meet a bunch of like people who physically could push themselves, right? When they find stuff out. But I think in the recent past, what we're finding is that it seems like this ultra running is a pathway to answering a question that you sort of put at the beginning. You said you thought you were living.
Yeah.
And you really didn't realize you weren't.
No.
You really weren't getting at sort of the questions that are almost impossible for us to answer, like what is our purpose and why are we here? But you're finding it out through this pathway, right? Like you still had your daughter, but had it not been for the running, you wouldn't have developed both the community interest and this sort of finding out about yourself and how powerful you really are as a person. I mean, running in a minute, but this is way more important. But you know, running 63 hours in a row is impossibly hard. But you didn't even know you were sitting on that power, right?
No.
Or the power to change people, right? So really fascinating, whether it was Bob Hearn talking about transcendence as he broke the record for the Vol State, because he himself has been on this journey as sort of a mathematician looking at running and now found the spiritual side of it. And then you and Dave and others and Blaine have found this community emotional side of it. And there's so much happening, but we have to get out of that sort of like medicating ourselves and opening ourselves up, right, to the what's really about around us. Do you think about that much?
Yeah. Yeah. As you said, like you would never have discovered this if it wasn't for something that came into your life. When I believe that people come into your life for a reason. And I think Alana came into my life for a reason. And it's like you find your purpose. You find your purpose in life. And she made a difference to me. I made a difference to her. And the knock-on effect is we make a difference to other people.
Absolutely. And Keith, for our listeners, this is the sad part of the discussion is that Alana passed away later on that year that you guys end up completing the marathon. And so when it comes to, I've got three kids myself. I couldn't imagine, Keith. How do you get out of bed the next day? How do you put your shoes on? How do you move forward from something like that?
Very difficultly. Difficulty. So 6 weeks after Dublin City Marathon, Alana passed away suddenly at home. I was heading out to work and I went in just to check on her and I found her dead in the bed. So you go from the highest of high from running Dublin City Marathon and just being the best, one of the best days of your life, to the lowest of lows of finding my daughter dead in her bed. Absolutely crushed me, I suppose I nearly went back into old ways, went back sort of drinking. I was sitting in a room all hours at night, smoking and listening to music and drinking. I went out walking the streets because I used to be out walking with her at nights. I went out walking the streets and I'd end up out at the graveyard, just sitting there, nearly lying there, just didn't want to be anywhere else. I'd go home and I'd lie in bed and I'd pray to God that I didn't wake up the next day because I could not live this life anymore. And that went on for, I'd say, about 4 or 5 months, that just praying to God you did not wake up the next morning. And it's scary. It's scary that you had that whole disregard for your own life. Like I was the early 30s and you have so much more life to live, but you didn't want it. You just didn't want to see it. So for me then, it was like there was no one coming to save me. I had to change how I thought. And we created so many amazing memories together that this is what I had to bring forward. Not what I seen that morning when I found her. It was the memories we created that whole year running Dublin City Marathon. Like I work in Dublin and I could come on to part of the marathon route just driving. And I could nearly visualize us running down the road when I'd smile to myself. Mm-hmm. Whereas I used to think of Alana and I just stop and I just start crying and you couldn't function. So I suppose your goal comes to, you basically go back to basics of like, right, my goal today is to get out of bed. My goal today is to go to work. My goal today is to do this. My goal, do you know what I mean? And you sort of build your goals in that way. So we organized then a memorial run for Alana in June of 20. So we were to hand over the bus to the Respite Care Center that we fundraised for. And the plan was that Alana would be there. Alana would hand over the keys. But obviously we were going to do that for her. And at that stage, I just made a choice that I was going to go back to run Dublin City Marathon again in 2018. And I was going to run it for Alana. And again, I was going to put everything back into what we had experienced, what we had done, and keep all these good memories, good vibes going. And just like she was sitting on my shoulder, laughing away.
Absolutely incredible.
So like, I went back to the marathon in 2018. And we were given the Lord Mayor's Medal, which is a medal that's given to somebody that's run the marathon for a special reason. And they also retired Alana's number from Dublin City Marathon, number 141. And Alana didn't run the marathon 10 times or 5 times. She ran it once. And it just shows the magnitude of what she done and what everybody thought of her. And everybody remembers her. She turned 8 years of age on the 4th of December and she died on the 13th. So everybody remembers her as Forever Eight. So at Mile Eight, there's always a little picture of her there, and people sort of salute her as they go by.
Yeah, just an incredible thing that you guys have done. And it probably as well too, Keith, you'll never quite know just the reach of the strength and courage and curiosity and everything that you've put forward to within the community and making people as well to go and strive to not only celebrate what they have, but also do things for others with purpose. And that's one of the things that I've come to understand through with the work that I'm doing with rare disease here in Canada.
And it's not like you want a thanks or anything like that. That's not.
No.
It's mad. No. But like some people would think that, but that's not the case at all. Like it's just you want to help.
Well, and I think that I can only speak for myself personally, but I've got two legs to complain about. My son's got a rare disease where he's ataxic, so lack of balance and coordination. And so running and moving for him is a challenge, getting dressed in the morning and feeding himself and on and so forth. And so, but that's his only special needs. When it comes to a lot of special needs kids, there's many, right? And it's a sliding scale. Some are a lot worse than others. But it's one of those things that you end up, it's not necessarily, I love running. I love pushing myself and going out and trying to be better. But yet also when you have that extra level of a purpose behind something where you're out there for a run, but you say, I want to share this with my son. I'm sure that you had many of those moments where you were like, I get to share this with my daughter. Was that a big part of your story?
Yeah, because when Lana was younger, she would have been so agitated and frustrated that she wouldn't come to me at all for about four or 5 years. She slept for an hour at a time. So you try to comfort her and I couldn't. She'd just be screaming, crying all the time. So that's why I ended up really bringing her out walking at 3 and 4 in the morning, just so that she got settled and sort of gave, I treated a couple of other kids as well, so that they could get asleep and stuff like that. And that it wasn't really in the house, just pure stress. So I was able to bring her out. She'd sort of doze off as we were walking around. And that's sort of then how we sort of started to build a bond together. And once we started running, there was just complete attachment then. And so it wasn't like this thing of like, oh my God, I just can't. It was, I was dying to get up in the morning to go running, where I couldn't wait for a Sunday morning to bring her out running and be out there for 3 and 4 hours just running around.
Yeah. As you work your way through that impossible process of loss and then trying to get yourself back on track, and then you start to think about, okay, I'm going to maybe do this ultra marathon thing at some point in the future. And there's always these outside kind of perspectives. Oh, just pick yourself back up and get moving. And it's not that people are callous as much as they don't understand how hard something is, right? And when did you sort of, I mean, of course, as you work through trying to get yourself back righted again, did you start to work on process like or a way for yourself to get resituated so that, and then ultimately that helps you with your running later on where you now know how you feel and how to do something about it? Because in the beginning, it's like hopeless, right? You don't know what to do.
Yeah, like you come to a point where you nearly feel guilty for being happy. You nearly feel guilty for smiling. People could look at you and go, like, he's lost his daughter. Like, how can he be smiling? How can he be happy? And I think once I sort of went into saying, okay, I want to run an ultramarathon. The first ultramarathon I done was Dublin to Belfast, which was 172 kilometers. So it wasn't like I went to 50K or 100. It was like straight in at nearly the top 82K. And I structured it that I'd go out on a Saturday morning and I could do 30K. And then Sunday I'd do 20K. And then I'd do Saturday 40K, Sunday 20K or 30K. So I'd sort of build it up alternate days. And the first 10K, I could spend where every emotion in my body would come out, crying, laughing, anger, frustration, that all come forward. But I was on my own and I don't show emotion as much, especially in front of people. And that's just the way I am. That's not because I think it's a weakness or anything. I think that's just the way I am. And like, even now, like I'll really just go out to the graveyard and have a cry out there and chat to her and stuff like that. And then that'll be it then. So doing these long distance running, being able to go out all hours at night, all hours in the morning on my own, this was how I was coping. And people look at it going, you're running away from it. And it's like, no, I'm actually running towards it because I have no choice when I'm out there on my own and it's in your head. You have no choice but to sort of work through it and answer the questions that's been asked of you. Mm-hmm. And when it gets tougher, this is where the questions become louder. So that voice is nearly telling you, going, you can't do this. And you're going, well, watch me, because I can, and I can get through that. When you get through something that's supposed to destroy you completely, and you can sort of come out the other end and you can be happy and you can be sort of functional. Mm-hmm. Well, then why can't you get through a training session, a tough training session? Why can't you get through a race? And like within a race, I don't think I'll ever feel physically or mentally strained as I did on that morning when I found Alana, when I was completely shattered. So your whole inner being is just gone. So I don't think I'll ever feel that. A race will never compare to that.
No, and I don't think it ever could. But I think there's so many parallels, Keith, with, unfortunately, the morning that you found Alana, you learned something that I hope that myself or Joe or anybody else I know doesn't have to learn. And that's this utter strength and perseverance by getting up and putting your shoes on day in and day out. It's a process. Most of us never really need to figure that out. And then we end up having to go and sign up for these races and putting this foreign process in front of us, this real difficult thing to be able to take those steps. And I think that's what backyard racing is all in perfectly, is you end up having these extraordinary athletes that go out and don't do well at backyard. And then you have people, for whatever reason in their life, they just don't quit. And they stick to that 4.18 mile loop every hour on the hour until they don't. And they've figured out their thought and feeling process. And like what you said, Keith, and maybe my next question is for me, at least personally, when I go out for a long, long training run or a long race or whatever, it quiets the noise. And you have to, you're forced to sit with your negative thoughts. I was once told it was take your negative thoughts out for tea and sit with them and talk to yourself. And everybody says, oh, you're running away from something. Well, or are you running with or towards something? Is that something that you find in your, maybe it's the ultimate therapy, going out and doing these hard things. So you tell me a little bit more about that.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, as you say there, like if you're out on your own and you're on a long training run, you're there on your own. You have these thoughts going around in your head anyway. So like if you're sitting at home and you're feeling down and you're thinking of things like this, you just seem to go down and down and down, which nearly hits the point of depression, because it's just going to keep, that's going to happen the next day, and it's going to happen the next day, and it's going to happen the next day. When you feel like that, and you go out for a run, or you go out for a training session, or whatever it is that you feel like, okay, I know I'm going to be asked these questions by myself in my head. It's like, how are you going to conquer this? How are you going to get over this? And and so that's running towards it, because when you come home, you feel so much better. It's like, I'm glad I got that out. And you could be out there for 5 or 6 hours and you're just glad I got that out. And people look at you and go like, how do you run for that length of time? How do you go out and do that on your own? And you go, because it's not just I'm running and looking at the ground, or I'm running and you're running and you're nearly homed into what I need to deal with in my head. And that is the whole healing process. I don't need to be going to counselors. Or I don't need to be going anywhere and talking to somebody that doesn't know me about my daughter, who they don't know either.
Yeah.
Whereas like I can be out there on my own talking to myself, and don't get me wrong, you don't get all the answers that you want, but you're honest with yourself, because you have to be. The time you stop, sort of push it to the background, then it's going to start to build up, and then you get that whole snowball effect again, that it's going to build up to a point that you're going to end up back where you are. So you have to deal with all these things that come forward. Now deal with them in smaller pieces. If they keep coming up, like, you just break it down to smaller sizes and you sort of work through it until you get to where you need to be.
Yeah, I think that it's just amazing for a guy who didn't start off on this path, how amazingly insightful and aware and powerful you've become. I mean, I'm actually just overwhelmed with how much you've explained about this sort of mystery that we all have to work through. You had it thrown smack in your face, but this mystery of impermanence of life, this mystery of what is our purpose? Why are we here? How do we use the power that we have? When you're sitting there, you're not using any power, right? So when you're like, you can run, like, I don't know, Dave can run a marathon every day. And then imagine if he took a day off. where does that power go that was sitting there? It's latent. It's available. So if you just stare, you never tease out what's possible. Now, you used it to deal with both a horrible, very difficult situation, but you're using it also now in this athletic pursuit, because when you were a kid, you didn't know that, right? And we our society sometimes allows us to sort of over-medicate ourselves, whether it's watching too much Netflix, having one too many other substances in our lives. We never really tease out, in some sense, what's possible. So you have to dig into that, which you started to do. And now you're, I would say, almost a master at it, because that doesn't mean you've mastered it, but you know now how to work that process, which is what we all need to learn. And sometimes it takes us 60, 70, 80 years to finally get that sort of insight. You found it earlier. And I just commend you for working it so hard to get that some control system in place that makes you function. Right? Because we want you here and we want all of us here. And sometimes it seems hard to make that happen. So yeah, just amazing.
Like, yeah, but like I'm still learning. I'm still learning about myself, and I'm still learning what is pushing me to my maximum. Like I done a race. It was a 50K race, but it was 4,000 meter ascent. And I went out hard. I probably went out too fast. And I got to the point where it was a warm day. I was lying in streams of water. I was lying on the ground, and I was like going, I can't quit. I was checking my body to just find anything just to say, oh, that's gone. I have to quit. And I was just sitting there going, I have to be honest with myself. And I would not be happy sitting here this evening or tomorrow going, I pulled out because of this, because I was going, that's a lie. I'd just be quitting for this, because I was just saying I could not do it. And once I got off the ground and I started moving forward, I stood on the top of the highest point, 720 meters. And I stood on the top of the last mountain. And I just handed my phone to a fella. I says, take a picture. Because I couldn't believe I was there. So I think it was more, you sort of build up that resilience. But I do that in training. Like, if I was injured, I hate rowing and I hate, the turbo bike. So I was injured there for about 2 months. And what I did was done a training plan to row 50K. So I'd done a 6-week training plan and I rowed 50K after it. And I hate rowing. Like I rowed 5K before that, probably about 2 years previous, because I didn't like it that much. But end up just rowing 50K. And I think it's just, you're sitting on that rower, the static rower, looking at a wall, and you're there for, it took me 3 hours and 40 minutes. You build up that mental resilience. And as I said, like you're doing these things, you're looking at a wall straight in front of you. So you have no other option but to go through what's going on inside your head.
And let's dive right into this, Keith, because I think that people are starting to put together why you're great at this. I've been running ultra marathons for 15 to 20 years. We had Michael Wardian on last week. Again, 15 to 20 years. You end up having these people that are building these engines. And you think, oh, it's physical. Well, yeah, there's parts that are mental. But no. There are guys like you that are coming onto the scene and just destroying the rest of the world. The John Stockers of the world. Where he's not gonna be fast enough to win, you know, the UTMB or whatever bigger race. But yet, for whatever reason, the guy just doesn't stop. And I think it comes down to, and tell me if I'm wrong, Keith, is there's an ultimate honesty. And let's be honest, me and you and Joe, let's be honest. At backyard, there's really not a reason to quit. You know, and this is where I think that it's really interesting that we're going to have 75 stubborn sons of bitches all showing up at the start line.
That's one way to put it.
And all of us have this little part of our brains where we're like, when other people feel something, they make a big deal about it and then they shut it down. But if you were ultimately honest, a 6.7 or a 4.1 mile looped course every hour on the hour, all you really are responsible for, Keith, is to get that loop done in time and do it responsibly, that you're fueling and drinking and eating and whatever. And showing up the next hour, it's not that hard. And Laz always says,
it's not that hard if you give yourself that out.
Right, exactly. If you never give yourself an out, I remember we were talking to Johan Steen, and he ended up winning Biggs 2017 or something. And I don't think in his brain there was ever an option that he was like, oh yeah, I'm not showing up or I'm not getting this loop done. I just don't think he ever gave himself that opportunity. And so really it's, you draw the parallels on where you see yourself in backyard racing and why you're new at this, but yet you end up your very first backyard race, you set the Irish national record of 63 hours and ultimately you won that. So you didn't find your finish. You didn't find your limit. So why is it that you, with your experience, are good at these things?
Well, it could be an element of naivety as well, is because it was my first one. You know, you didn't know what you're getting into.
But yeah, yeah.
At the same time, I said the same to my brother and a friend of mine was crewing for me. And a couple of weeks beforehand, we went through the whole thing of, right, food and stuff like this. And it was a case of, right, there is a non-negotiable of, like, there's not a chance that we're not going to turn up to the start line. If I'm in the tent, it's a non-negotiable. No matter what happens, we go to the start line. When you hit, say, 50 odd hours, everybody's body is sore. Everybody's body is tired. Mm-hmm. If it's not, there's definitely something wrong.
Yeah.
So everybody's feeling the same thing. It's only the people that mentally feel that pain that start to dwindle.
Yeah.
So if you can mentally block all that pain out, which obviously with what I've been through pain-wise of finding Lana and losing my daughter and living each day like that, like there's not a day goes by I don't think about Alana. But if I was to let that in on me every single day, I wouldn't get out of bed. So I have nearly mastered, or I'm learning to get to the point of like, okay, no matter what pain it is at that point in time, I can block that out. I was looking as well that I had taken a full week off work. So this race was on a Saturday and I'd say taking the week off. And I was like, there is nowhere else I want to be, only here. And I don't want to stop and go home and be looking at, oh, who's still going and looking for updates. Why don't I just stay here and I'll be able to see the updates live myself?
Yeah, create the updates. Yeah.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah.
It's great that what you're stating, and Dave and others who are doing really great, it's about reframing. And we are sort of born into one frame of way of thinking that we've normalized in society, and it inhibits and limits what's possible, right? Because really when we try and figure out, like, there's this suffering versus pain, and if you twist your ankle and it blows up so big you can't get around a loop, that's real pain. That's not what we're talking about.
Yeah.
This is this idea of suffering, right? Which is sort of accepting what is going on. And the system that's giving us this data is actually not giving us good data. Because for the most part, look, you did the 63 hours. In a day or two, you were doing pretty good. Next day, you probably is walking around, sort of sitting back on the couch and doing some. So we're early warning system isn't great, and because it says stop. Yeah. So we just have to do this reframing. And I think the ones who reframe and accept, to your point, Keith, that everyone feels the same. So like, oh, that's what I came here to do, is to feel like this. What would have happened?
As you say there, Joe, like, granted, if you twisted your ankle, if you went over on your ankle, if you twisted your knee, there's so many things that you go, okay, structurally, this is not good for me to carry on. And that's fine. That's understandable. But when you come to like an ache or a pain or stiffness, you know yourself, Dave, like every hour you get up and you're walking like John Wayne to the start line. And then once you get it going, you're fine that you loosen out like after a couple of kilometers.
How is this going to work? Yeah, totally. Yeah, no doubt.
Yeah.
So, I find you have to take, like I say, 50 strides.
Yeah.
And you feel every one of your tissues that have glued themselves together. And you're like, how on earth is this going to work? I remember I was running across the Canada in 2018. And every morning I'd wake up and I would get out on where I finished the previous day. And I was running 100, 110 kilometers a day. And the first like kilometer, you're like, how on earth is this going to work? Yeah. Like this, I am not moving well. I look like Frankenstein. And then you're never great, but you're just okay. And I think that's what the backyard race kind of lends it to is I was thinking about it the other day, and I haven't said it yet, so I guess it's kind of coined as, like, I'm going to coin it as, you don't have to be great, just don't suck. Just show up at the start line. Yeah. And Laz always says, he says, the hardest part of the race course isn't the 4.18 miles. It's the 5 feet between your chair and the start line. It's getting Absolutely. Your ass out of the. And so you find that there's a non-negotiable. Like it's, I will show up. I'm going to try my best to get done that loop. Is that what goes on in your mind?
Yeah. At 50 hours in, there was a time when I thought, right, okay, I'll time out. If I time out, that's fine. I can live with that. You know what I mean? I didn't make it to the finish line. But then I was like, you have to bring yourself back to that moment and go, that's not what I want. I want to be here till the end. So you sort of bring you just sort of build everything back in and you sort of take a moment and you talk to yourself and going, right, okay, we get to the finish line. We get something to eat. We get a bit of a rest, a sleep or whatever. Go out on the next one and see how I'm feeling. And if that happens again, we'll see, can we get to the finish? Do the same again. And then we'll go on the next one and see how we feel on that one. And after a couple of times or a couple of hours of that, you break through that barrier of, I need to stop or I need to time out. When you come out the other side, it's like it's the vision that you get when you come out the far side of that. It's like you see everything so much clearer. Everything just seems to brighten up. Everything seems to come into high definition at that stage. And you're going, my God, I've just come through probably the toughest part of this race now. All you can do is go up. Now, obviously, another hour, it can drop back down again. But at that point in time, you've gotten through when you wanted to stop. So you're basically on the upward slope.
So Keith, in the race when you won the 63 hours, were you sort of surprised when your number two dropped? And how did sort of it end in like, we were like, oh my God, could have kept going, or I'm glad it's over, or how did it feel? How was that whole?
Well, there was four of us left for the last 20 hours.
Okay.
And then Amy went to 59. Then Peter went at 61. So it just seemed to drop one after the other fairly quick, which is what happens in these races, because one person drops and everyone else's mind starts going, oh my God, people are starting to go now. And it just ended up myself and Jeevy, and I walked up to the start line and I just said to him, look, I says, there's only one way this is going to finish. It's going to be me or you, and it's not going to be me.
And what was the look on his face when you told him that?
We went out on that loop, on the 63rd loop, and he was always a bit slower than me. So we had to go up around the manor and then back around. And I was coming back towards him and he stopped me and he said, I'm done. I said, really? And he was like, yeah. And I shook his hand. I thanked him. I gave him a hug. And I said, right, I have to go. And I just have to make it in within this hour. Obviously, within these races, you can't believe what everybody tells you either. So you still have to move and to make sure that I make it back. And if he made it back, we're going again. But I was just about to turn down into the forest. And one of the guys there just said to me, look, two things. He says, Jeevy's definitely gone. And he said, just make it around with the end of the hour and enjoy it. And it's the most nerve-wracking hour, because you've ran the same route for 62 hours and you're just going, geez, I hope I don't get lost on this one.
Yeah. This loop is the one that you screw up.
Finishing in the daytime or the nighttime?
It finished about 3 o'clock in the morning. And that's what I was saying. Like, we had another 2 hours of darkness. And when you come back into light again, you get a whole new lease of life. And I'd expect everyone that wins one of these races to say the same, that I could have kept going. And I know John said the exact same thing. And I would expect anyone that won one to say the same, that I could have kept going. And I was just going, right, 2 hours of darkness, we're back into daylight again, and then you have another probably 10 hours of that. So I was thinking, going, right, we should hit about 75 hours here. But I'm surprised then when GV pulled out, I was like, fair enough.
Well, it's amazing when you look around, like even at Biggs, you'll see the start-finish line and it says there is no finish. When I know at Biggs in 2019, I ended up in third, and it drops down from 75 to 50 to 25 down to 10. And you start looking around and you're like, that guy looked so good. And now he's gone. And I think when it gets down to the final four, you look at one another, and the moment that you think there's no way on earth I'm going to beat that person is the moment that you start to, I always think of that, the two dogs. You have one dog on one side and one dog on the other. And then one dog is telling you you're great and strong and capable and you can do this all day. The other one is saying, hey, give up. You can't beat that guy. Pay attention to the soreness in your legs and joints. And what dog wins and what dog gets the loudest is the one that you feed. And that's so
that's where training is vital.
Absolutely. And so how did you, in that 63-hour win, how did you not feed that dog?
As I said, I've trained that in training. I there's not 1 hour that I did not want to go to the start line. Not one. Mm-hmm. And it's probably because before the race, we had that talk and we said it's a non-negotiable. So if I had said, I don't want to go, they weren't going to listen to me anyway. They would have been picking me up and pushing me out the door of the tent. So either way, I think it was hour 50, I came into the tent after that bad lap that I was going to time out. And I said to my brother, I need to lie down. And I lay down and I got eight minutes sleep. And it was the best 8 minutes sleep that I got. I got up out of that and I was completely revitalized again. But yeah, you do it in training. You do the things that you don't like and you do it like you love it. And I do repetitive things that could be boring and people look at going, how do you manage that? But you do it over and over and over again. To the point of like, you're nearly like a robot. You just completely zone out of what you're doing, what you're training, and you can just keep going.
Yeah, that's a good. So what do you think about, you have 4 weeks to go. How's your training going? How are you feeling about getting over to Tennessee and duking it out with the crew?
It's exciting. And because Europe is sort of restricted to the US at the minute, we're sort of just waiting to see if the restrictions are lifted now on Wednesday or Thursday. And then we'll know whether we're going there. If they're not lifted, we'll be going to Germany and it'll be running in conjunction with it. But obviously, like, you want to go to Biggs. Like, that's where it's at. And as you said, like, all the big names and last one standing running is going to be there. And you want to be toeing the line with all them. And you want to be standing there and you want them looking at you going, oh, who's this fella? Or who's, do you know what I mean? Who's this fella? You know, so yeah, it's I suppose what dreams are made of, isn't it? At the end of the day, like, as I said, like, there's a time in my life when I was going to bed and I didn't want to wake up the next day. Now I'm going to probably one of the biggest races in the world. It's fast becoming a big sport in ultra running, the last one standing event. And probably because of that fact that you don't have to be fast. You just have to be stubborn and go to
relentless.
Yeah,
absolutely.
If we've met a few of those, huh?
Yeah. We've got a lot of stubborn folk on our podcast. Absolutely. But I think that's what's beautiful is that during this time in this pandemic, I mean, Keith, I think that all of our listeners could agree that we all have our struggles. Some people have bigger struggles and have gone through harder things. And that's you in the last many years. And you could either take those struggles and they cripple you. You're rendered useless, or you could take those struggles and become a concrete, better self, propelling yourself to do greater, bigger things, more concrete things, more substantial things in your life because you're capable. And most of us, if we didn't need to learn those things, you wouldn't ever charge face first into a ring of fire. You just wouldn't do that. But if you're there and you exit, you're all the stronger. And so at Biggs, what's in store for you? Is this going to be one of these, who the hell is this Keith guy? And why is he still running at 120 hours in?
Well, I suppose the last thing I ever wanted was people to pity me or look at me and go, God, that fella, like, he lost his daughter and like, he just can't cope. That's not what I wanted. I suppose I probably want people to look at me and go, look how he is coping with the loss of his daughter. And as I said, like, Alana showed me a way of life that I never even thought imaginable. Like, I got to represent my country there last month in the 100K. Again, something that would have never, ever been on my radar to do that. And now to go to probably one of the biggest races in the world. Like everybody wants to be the first person to hit 100 miles or 100 in last one standing. And looking at the lineup that's there, it's, my God, it's getting closer and closer. It's like really the four minute mile, isn't it? That like it's the 100 hour will be hit. And then you'll get a few people then after that are going to hit it because there's people that are going to look at this sport and go, wow, I can do that. And like me, come into it late, but with, I suppose, the mental resilience and the will not to give up. And I think that's why this race sort of suits me because there's no finish line and I'm prepared to be there for as long as it takes. All I have to do is just keep showing up at the start line.
Just don't book a return flight. That's it.
the key is you need a race like Biggs because you need someone else who's going to do 99.
Exactly.
And that's the sort of the most interesting part about this. You can't just decide to do 100. I mean, you could do that from your house if you wanted to, but that's not the race. That's going to be sort of fascinating.
That's the amazing part of that race, is that like you have to have someone to go that distance, which is well.
And you'd build, as we've learned, and Dave knows this personally, is you build some real rapport with that person.
Oh, yeah.
And there's this interesting bond that gets created and a dependency that doesn't happen in really any race.
No, you don't want them to drop out. But at the same time, they have to drop out, obviously, for you to win. But the way I look at it was that I wasn't relying on somebody else to drop out, because then your race is focused on what they do. Your race will be focused on you and you alone. So you just do what you can do, and that's just keep showing up and keep getting around. Mm-hmm. They'll do what they do and their race strategy. But if you start focusing on that, that's when your decline starts to come. You just need to focus on your own race.
Well, I think it comes about a little bit roundabout as well, too, at Biggs, Keith, is because in 2019, I was there and it goes down from 10 to 5 to 4 to 3 to 2 to 1. And you're looking at the other runners and thinking, I have a responsibility to them to find either the bottom of your well or the end of your rope. But, you know, the third part of the prong, and I can't wait to ask you about this, is that I would always look over at the other runners and then immediately I would look over at Laz. And you always knew where Laz was, is because there's one person smoking and I can't stand the smell of smoke. But yet in his backyard, I love it because you always know where he is. And it's just this sign, it's a smell, it's this taste even in your mouth of this diabolical hillbilly that makes us do crazy things. And this guy ends up creating these events. Like, who the hell would have ever thought of running a 4-mile loop every hour on the hour until you can't, outside of this diabolical hillbilly from Tennessee? And so we have a responsibility to him as well, too, because he's sitting back and painting this picture, writing this poetry of human excellence and just grit and not quitting. How do you feel about that? How do you feel about the responsibility that we have towards this chain smoking hillbilly?
Yeah, to be honest, which I never really thought about it like that. Like, as in, you sort of look at it, you have a responsibility to other runners there. Say, as you said, push them as far as they can while pushing yourself as far as you can go. And when you think about it, like as you described there with Laz, like obviously the race director, he wants to find the pinnacle of human endurance. And that's why he creates these races to do that. Like Mark is the exact same, and he loves to see people suffer, and it's not suffer in a bad way, it's suffer to find their peak. It's not even a breaking point, it's their peak of how far they can push themselves. There's people there, they'll finish within a minute or less, and they grab something, they turn around and they go back to the start line again, and you're just going, wow, that is just amazingly fair enough. Someone that comes in with 10 minutes to spare to get a rest, to get a drink, but it's that person that comes in just on time each time and turns and goes again and turns and goes again and turns and goes again.
And I think absolutely. And the best example I can give is my own personal experience. When I was at Biggs and I knew I wasn't going to make it back off that lap because I ran into some trouble with hydration, and I think it was on hour 53. And my first immediate thought out there was I felt an element of shame. And when I end up getting back to the start-finish line, and before Maggie and Will end up getting back, I saw Laz and I walked over to him and I looked at him and I told him, I said, Laz, you told me that you can only have good laps, not bad laps. And I said, I had a bad lap. And that was almost an apology to him. Like, I know that I could have done better for you. I know I could have created a better, bigger, I know I could have gone 72 hours. And he just gave me a hug and he said, you did good, kid. And I told him, I said, you know, Laz, I need to come back again because I didn't leave myself out here. Like, I could do better. And it was a really interesting experience because I talked to all the other runners and they had a similar experience where they felt that the creator of all of this, you owed something to him to give it your best. And if you didn't give it your best, you felt an element of shame. It's an interesting feeling.
Yeah. But it's a fear as well. It's a real fear that you drop out too soon before you actually is your time. And I think a lot of people going into a race like this, that is their fear, is that if I stop at 40 hours and they sit down and they go, I had another hour in me, or I had another 2 hours or 3 hours in me. And when I'm at these races, not running even, just going up and have a look, talking to runners that come in and say, I'm done, you try to go, look, just sit down, get something to eat and go to the start line again. And if you don't make a round, that's fine. But so many are reluctant to go back to the start line again. Mm-hmm. They just go, no, their mind is made up that they're done. And I think that's probably what separates the people going to the backyard to the people that sort of like, you're sort of going, I just find that sometimes find it hard to understand why they just won't take that 5 minutes, reset themselves, just go to the start line again and try one more. And if you get around that, don't get me wrong, I'll be saying the exact same thing again. I'm going, just try one more. It's a never-ending cycle. But if you do that twice or three times, that's when you're going to find how far you can push yourself. It's like, what was it? If you think you're done, you're only 60% of the way there or whatever it is. And I suppose there's an element of truth in that as well. But I think like you just have to keep going. Mm. Okay, I'll go one more. Especially when you come down to that point of I'm done, but you're still in the corral to go again.
Yeah, it's I think one of the life lessons is just one more in everything. That doesn't matter what it is, whether it's running an extra mile or putting an extra hour in, I don't know, work or cleaning the house or everything. It's in that sort of that next moment when we start to build and break through and really pull away and differentiate ourselves. And, you know, what's interesting, Keith, about your journey is I've been writing about this for a long time, but I would say that true privilege is earned and not granted. And I think we often think that it's something that we were given, but we actually have to go out and earn it. And you've been just an amazing example of that. And we just wish more people would find themselves in their pathway to these opportunities of demonstrating to ourselves, if nothing else, what we're about and who we are. And I think that with 4 weeks to go, we'll hope for sure that the U.S. opens up the borders and lets you here so you can put your shoulder next to Dave and everyone else on the course. Beyond sort of this short-term backyard, what do you think about yours chasing tomorrow, your sort of next few years? How are you seeing it evolve?
Like, as I said, I started running ultra run in 2019. So like I have so much to learn. And I think going to the backyard ultra to line up with Dave and Maggie and Courtney and all them, you can learn so much off these people. And if you're, it's the same as anything. If you're playing or training or racing with people at the higher level, you're going to step your game up to their level or push yourself as far as you can to their level. So for me, it's gaining a lot of experience through training and hopefully get back to bigs again the following year. I know it's every second year now, isn't it, after that? So it's qualifying to get back in there. But with the format being changed and it's nearly the best of the best, so within your own country, you have to win. So like it's an ever growing, it's an expanding sport within ultra running. You're going to start seeing people come into this that have been marathon running or not even running at all that are going to progress in this sport. You're going to see faces like even like myself, like going to bigs, like no one would know who I am. Do you know what I mean? I hopefully in a few years' time they do know who I am going to it. But yeah, look, I'm here to enjoy myself and build up my own life experiences and be happy at the end of the day. Like I get up in the morning and I chase the sunset. I could go up a mountain just to see the sun rise because of the point of time that I was in my life that I didn't want to wake up anymore. Now I want to go and see it and I want to live it.
Well, I might say that you're the exact example of chasing tomorrow, which is we've always, Dave and I say, come chase tomorrow with me, because that's sort of what our obligation is really at the end of the day.
Yeah, I mean, Keith, I have no question that in less than a month from now, that the ultra marathon running world will know exactly your name and what you're all about and the strength and perseverance. And I can't wait to toe the line with you in Tennessee. Let's open up that border. Joe, if you can go ahead and call Washington and get everybody on board.
Just get me a visa.
Get all those Europeans in. But yeah, Keith, I want to thank you for your time with Chasing Tomorrow podcast. And I can't wait to finally meet you in less than a month.
Yeah, look, Dave, I appreciate that. And to be honest, I really hope that we can get into the US so I can meet yourself and sort of have a chat as well while we're doing a few loops. I'm sure we'll get to know each other a lot better, you know, and it'd be great to line up beside you and just sort of build some experience off you too.
Yeah. All the love, Keith.
Thank you, Keith. Really appreciate
Thanks very much, Joe, as well. Nice to meet you and great to have a chat with you.
Yes, very much so. Thank you. Dave, you know, I know we're not supposed to have favorites, but Keith is just one of the most amazing people we've had on the podcast. I mean, to endure what he had to with Alana and still hang in there and to run the way he does, I mean, it's just incredible. I also feel his level of insight into what life is all about and how to connect more deeply with our journey was just so amazing to hear. Wow, that was just incredible. Okay, well, there you have it. That's a wrap for this week. As always, a shout out to our sponsor, Performance Tea. You can find them on www.performancetea.com. They've given us a discount code for any of our listeners to get 20% off their purchase. Just use Chasing20 at checkout. And we would greatly appreciate if you could follow us on Instagram and give us a review on Apple Podcasts. That would be awesome. And as always, a huge thanks to our listeners for coming with us on this journey and chasing tomorrow with us. Thanks very much.